This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the museum. Thanks for coming on a holiday week. My name's Karen Pittar. I work in the development team at the museum, and we love having the CAS lectures, so thank you for coming along. But before we begin tonight, as we always do at the National Museum, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians on whose lands we're meeting this evening. I'd like to pay my respects to their elders past, present and future, and to extend that to other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders here today. It's my great pleasure now to introduce to you Dr. Susan McIntyre-Tamoy.
Okay. Now, I've been told not to move around too much because I normally do that because they're recording it, so I'll try and stay in the one place. So, it's not quite archaeology, but, you know, it is heritage, so I thought I'd do something slightly different. In the past couple of years, I've been lucky enough to undertake a number of small research projects in Southeast Asia relating to intangible cultural heritage. It set me up thinking about the challenges and opportunities that the 2003 Convention poses and what benefits it might bring if applied in the Australian context. As you'll have read in the abstract, if the abstract was distributed, I'm not sure if it was, Australia is one of the few countries that has not ratified the 2003 UNESCO Convention. Significantly, it's the large Western nations, Australia, Canada, USA, New Zealand and the UK, who share a similar colonial past that have so far not ratified that convention. But perhaps it's time to restart a national conversation on this issue, because it's clearly not an attitude that all of our neighbours are feeling. So that's the advertisement for our company. That's me. And I can see that we have a past president of IKICH here, which is the International Committee for Intangible Cultural Heritage, and a current Secretary General of that committee. So I'll acknowledge Marilyn. But before we start, I'd like to ask each of you to think about what cultural practices you and your family value. Post-it note is coming up. Perhaps they're passed down from the quintessential Australian country lifestyle, or perhaps they've been passed down from your great-grandparents in another country. Like my colleague at work, whose family has this cute Easter tradition of covering their eggs with crocheted egg covers. Ta-da! There they are. Perhaps it's the smell and taste of lamb shank and a damper cooked over a campfire. Whatever it is, I'd like you to write down on your post-it note at least one activity, experience, knowledge or skill that you would wish you could maintain and pass on to future generations. Once you've done that, just take your time, but once you've done it, just pass it along to the edge and my colleague Joel will collect them all. So I'll give you a few minutes for that and I'll give you a reminder that I need them. So I think it's really important because, in fact, we did end up having a little bit of a, white man has no culture cringe in Australia, I think. And that's actually, you know, gets in the way of us thinking broadly about how this convention might be implied. So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about how we construct notions of cultural heritage in Australia and how that differs from our neighbours, particularly in the Asia Pacific. And then I'm going to briefly introduce the 2003 Convention, and some of you will know it, just bear with me, because I'm assuming that... How many people do know the 2003 Convention? Not many, good. Only those... you guys can sleep or fill in your post-it notes during that period. And then I'm going to... I think it's worth identifying what is meant by ICH under the Convention, because I often find that when I talk to my fellow Australians, that people make assumptions as to what is inferred by the term intangible cultural heritage. And I think a lot of them base that understanding on the long discussions that have happened about heritage in this country around Indigenous spiritual values in landscapes and places. So I think, and that is, of course, part of what we mean when we say intangible cultural heritage, but it's not, in fact, how it's defined under the Act. Under the Convention. Once we've established a bit of a shared understanding of what I'm talking about, I'll explore with you a few examples from overseas that I've had a look at that I think could be of interest to us here in Australia if we try to think about innovative ways that we could apply something similar here. And finally, I'll share with you some of my thoughts on how the convention might be relevant to us here and how it might benefit local communities. So, how we think about heritage. There's lots of definitions about heritage and cultural heritage. And, you know, Australia has a really reputation for very active engagement in heritage conservation. So we're one of the first nations, for instance, that ratified the World Heritage Convention. And we did that before it even passed into, whatever they call it, decided and agreed to at the UNESCO meeting, but before it actually came into play. So we did that by August 1974, which was only 6 months after the meeting, where everyone agreed that the convention would be adopted. So we have a very structured approach to heritage in Australia, though. And over the years, we've developed a number of sort of methodologies and guidelines and things that actually help us streamline the way we identify and assess heritage. So that's sort of been really positive because it means that our standards are really high and we can hold each other to account and we all know what's expected. It makes it easier to write a brief for a project and to deliver something. But it's also, in some ways, a bit limiting because I find, particularly with a lot of my younger colleagues, they often are confined in thinking by those guidelines and methodologies. And I'm thinking particularly, say, in New South Wales, where you have strange methodologies around Aboriginal heritage, where I went to Queensland for 7 years and came back and found everyone was just gone, were just idiots, and they were digging little squares everywhere. And who knows why? Certainly nothing to do with archaeology and finding out and addressing methodologies to particular projects. So I think we're so used to all these guidelines that it somehow limits how we think about things. And people come out of universities now limited in that way. They move into consulting and then they're, you know, refined a bit more and we control them a bit more so we save a bit of time and money. And, you know, they pop out somewhere at the end without having had many opportunities to think big. And so hopefully I'm not putting any tickets on myself about this will make you think big, but I'm hoping that I'll at least prize a little crack in people's minds. So guiding documents, though, such as the Borough Charter, the Australia Icomos Charter for Places of Cultural Significance, are really looked on very favourably across the world. And if you look at the definitions in those, where they define cultural significance very broadly, you'll see in there that there are intangible elements, if you like, in that definition. So, for instance, it defines cultural significance as aesthetic, historic, scientific, social or spiritual, which are obviously can be intangible. They can be tangible, they can be intangible, for past, present or future generations. And it further notes that cultural significance is embodied in the place itself, and not just its fabric, but also its setting, its use, its associations and meanings, records, related places and related objects. So there again, you've got an intangible element, but that seems to be, in a way, how we're seeing, when we talk about intangible cultural heritage, we're limiting ourselves in that way. Well, sometimes we're not even doing that, with truth be known, because not all of that is done very well. But anyway, the definition is there. There is, of course, an understanding that embedded in these definitions, in this heritage, that there will be values beyond the material and that the places can be associated with a whole range of intangible concepts, such as spirituality, aesthetics, and all those sorts of things. However, despite this great definition, in Australia, I think there's a separation between what we talk about as cultural heritage and what we refer to as the arts. Cultural heritage is generally seen as places, sites and objects, and the arts as that evolving heritage tradition of art, theatre, song, dance, all those sort of things. And I think this is key to the difference that we have with many other people and why a lot of other people don't understand that we limit ourselves in when we talk about heritage. So, obviously, we think cultural heritage exists in landscapes, and then that can have an intangible, as well as the tangible natural values, can have an intangible aspect to it. And we also see, obviously, our cultural buildings as being important, and we talk about feelings with these, and we talk about things being awe-inspiring, we talk about a whole range of things which are intangible, but again, associated with buildings. And of course, our important archaeological sites, particularly Aboriginal sites, but also other sites, sites that might be associated with particular aspects of our colonial past that are poignant, you know, like Port Arthur and places like that. And we see them having an intangible aspect as well. But elsewhere in other parts of the world, and particularly in the Asia Pacific, Cultural heritage is seen as something different. Cultural heritage is seen as an entire life way. Cultural heritage is seen as this crossover between archaeology, architecture, anthropology, sociology, musicology, all of these ologies. And that's, you know, food is in there, and musical instruments, puppets. Puppets are big through Asia, everywhere. Also the buildings. They do recognise the buildings and the structures and the archaeology, but they also see all these other things as part of our cultural heritage. So I think this really is, they don't see the separation between the arts that we see, and perhaps that's because when they're talking about arts, they're often talking about traditional arts, and a lot of the discussions I've had with people is, how do we keep things authentic? How do we, what happens when it's commercialised? All of these sorts of things. And perhaps it's healthy that we see the arts as something that's very evolving, but we also do see some of the parts of the arts as traditional and parts of our traditions, but there's no way of sort of incorporating that easily into our definitions of heritage. So the convention seeks to reflect this diversity of heritage that you can see in that picture by defining intangible cultural heritage as the practices, representations, expressions, knowledge, skills, and as well as the instruments, objects, artifacts, and cultural spaces, which is a very important one, associated with them. And that communities, groups, and in some cases individuals recognise these things as part of their cultural heritage. So this intangible cultural heritage, transmitted from generation to generation, is constantly recreated by communities and groups in response to their environment, their interaction with nature, their history, and provides them with a sense of identity and continuity. So this is a very changing view of heritage in there, because and that's another thing as well, because you're not actually conserving or preserving these things under this convention. You're recognising and you are documenting, but the documentation is more about promotion and about elevation and awareness raising and the protection of strengthening of transmission of these things. So it's really recognised as a much more changing view than we have sometimes seen when we talk about heritage. So the Convention for Intangible Cultural Heritage. So there's three lists under the convention. There's a representative list of intangible cultural heritage of humanity, and there's currently 508 elements listed from 122 countries. And the whole point of this, as I said, was to ensure better visibility for the intangible cultural heritage, with the idea that this will, you know, it's a UNESCO convention after all, so it's about harmonising and respect and creating mutual understanding. So the idea is to share these things and to promote them, and that in doing so, people will start to learn about each other and learn about the diversity and appreciate the diversity of culture. Now, I have to say here, there are lots of problems with the convention and the way that it's implemented, and I'm not going into them in this thing, but happy to answer any questions, because I know Marilyn's going to throw them at me anyway. But in fact, this I'm talking about here, I'm really, I guess I'm flying a lot, hot kite, or is it shooting a bow? I'm not sure what I'm doing. Whatever that expression is, I'm trying to make people think about the positive possibilities that we could get in this. So there's the second list is the list of intangible cultural heritage in need of urgent safeguarding. And that's a really important aspect, because that's when people are identifying things which are threatened for one reason or another. And there are lots of threats in the modern world for various pieces of intangible cultural heritage, because some of them are, the spaces for some of them are disappearing. As places commercialise and develop, people are losing the spaces where they perform things. You have things where people are losing cultural heritage because it's being stolen and mass reproduced and things like that. So there's that list is meant to be an action, call to action list. And there's been one or two successful interventions there where people have come up with a plan of how to safeguard it. I've found them quite interesting and creative. There's a lot still on that list, and there's some of them that are very problematic. Then, of course, there's the register of good safeguarding practices. And there are quite a few things on this list at the moment. There's 59 elements on the list for cultural heritage in need of urgent safeguarding. But on the register for good safeguarding practices, they've now got up to 20 projects since 2003. They've really struggled with this, and they've just had a consultancy that they let for people to actually find out ways to actually encourage people and promote people of putting forward projects, good practice projects, and they struggle with that. Okay, but safeguarding is the word used instead of conservation, and safeguarding is defined in Article 3 of the Convention to mean measures aimed at ensuring the viability of the intangible cultural heritage, including the identification, documentation, research, preservation, protection, promotion, enhancement, transmission, particularly through formal and non-formal education, as well as the revitalisation of the various aspects of such heritage. So anything and everything, basically. So how intangible cultural heritage is defined by the Convention? It has a really broad definition because it's meant to include all the practices, the representations, the expressions, everything. And when you think of it, so one of the things it does is try and break it down into something that's manageable for people. So in Article 2 of the Convention, it talks about the elements. There's five domains, if you like: oral traditions and expressions, including language as a vehicle for the intangible cultural heritage, performing arts, social practices, rituals and festive events, knowledge of and practices concerning nature and the universe, and traditional craftsmanship. So people are looking at things under those domains, and so often people think, well, it's a really odd thing, isn't it? Because what's being put up to be listed is, a musical instrument, the kaan or something from Laos. But it's not just the musical instrument. In fact, it's the knowledge system around the musical instrument. It's the craftsmanship, the knowledge of how to make it. So with that instrument, for instance, all the people who make it are very elderly, and no one else, they've got no apprentices. And so the safeguarding measure for this, it's an item in need of urgent safeguarding, not because someone's going to destroy all the kaans, and not because people don't still play it, but there's no one around, or there's very few people around, who actually know the traditional methods of making it. So the things that are added to the list are added, you know, as a focal point in like a world, a knowledge system that surrounds that thing. So it can be quite intriguing about when you start thinking about how do you safeguard these things. So I've said that more or less. Okay, so threats to ICH. There's a great little thing on the, called, I think it's called Dive Into ICH on the UNESCO website, which is where this image comes from. And you probably can't read all the small threats in there, but the big groups across the top are things that you'll recognise because they're threats not just to ICH, they're often threats to the tangible heritage as well. So this little project that they did analysed 59 ICH items inscribed on the list in need of urgent safeguarding, and they identified 9 common threads and negative attitudes, and that could include things like repressive policies or government policies as well. So you could look at Myanmar and the Rohingya, for instance, or it could be negative attitudes that are within communities. It could be a whole range of things. Demographic issues, decontextualization, where things are taken out, and sometimes this can be done when people think they're safeguarding. You know, things are taken out of context, and then what do you lose when that happens, and what happens to it? And a lot of people I spoke to in Asia, particularly Cambodia and Laos and a few other places, well, mainly there, actually, the places that are doing very little actual work for cultural heritage. But they also are always caught up in the arguments about, well, what happens when someone takes this and does something else with it? How do we stop them? How do we control them? And that's a really difficult question to start with, and they get bogged down with that and can't really do anything with it. But they can all quote examples of things that have been decontextualised or weakened, the weakened practice of transmission. So if kids aren't interested in learning, there's no new apprentices. I've got a case study where one, which is a very successful business, but can't find an apprentice because it's not a popular thing nowadays. Environmental degradation. That changes the way people can fish, they can hunt, all the systems around it. That means the tools and the things that they used to use don't work anymore. Cultural globalisation. New products and techniques coming in, and that's one of the actually a very big issue. People are making things cheaper. They're industrialising a lot of processes. And so, you know, what is lost in that system when somebody comes in and sets up a factory for gold leaf making instead of making it by hand? New products and techniques, loss of objects or systems, and economic pressures. So just a couple little case studies. I was lucky when I was in India for the last ICOMOS General Assembly there that I did a little thing with Ananya Bhattacharya, who's also in the International Committee for Intangible Cultural Heritage. And she runs an NGO called BangladeshTech.com. And that NGO is a social enterprise NGO that focuses on changing people's lives through intangible cultural heritage. One of the places we went to was to the Singing Scroll Painters. This is amazing. I mean, they were just amazing women. For generations, these women were particularly impoverished, and they've always had these songs. They've always had the ability to do the paintings. But basically, the only employment in this around this particular village was seasonal work in the fields for the men, and then a lot of the money frittered away, and the women, particularly young women, were finding it very difficult. No one even outside their own village would marry them, that sort of thing. So this enterprise was set up here to change the life of that whole village too, and it has. It's changed the women's lives, who are now in control of the economy. It changed the kids' lives. They've got all new housing. They've got a cultural centre. And it's all done with limited funding. It's through the other UNESCO small micro enterprise funding or something, and through the work of this particular thing. So basically, it started off as people painting traditional stories and singing them. But now people still do that, but they also paint more contemporary ones. So there's Osama bin Laden. There's the Twin Towers being exploded, and here's the evil plane, the planes and stuff. I saw a fantastic one of those that was long. The women just came out and they... Sorry, I'm moving. They came out and they rolled out this huge scroll, and it had the plane on that one was white, but had an evil... from the 1950s sort of Mighty Mouse era moustache, and it had the US president with golden hair, which must have been prophetic because now, of course, there is one. But, you know, it was obviously the idea that this is what a Western American would look like. But all the dyes are natural, and so they have a little visitor centre, and you can go and they can give you a little free chart of how to make all the dyes from all the different things. And it's just fantastic. So they paint a scroll, and then they'll sing it for you. And the whole thing is sung as a group. One of the other places went to is this Dokra craft of Duryapur. And this, I've actually got some Dokra beads on. So Dokra is a lost wax method of bronze work. And so it's, you know, it's just one of those methods that's been around for a very, very long time. And it does occur in other parts of India as well. But the little story behind this is that the legend, about 3,000 years ago, the king of Bastar, which is in the state of Chhattisgarh, which is, I think, where we were, was given a Dokra necklace for his wife, and he greatly admired it. He gave the craftsman the title of Gadwa, a title derived from the word Galna, which is meaning the melting and working of wax. And a few hundred years ago, that craft form became very popular with craftsmen travelling across India. So you'll find it in a whole range of places. But today, the craft is still practiced in pockets of India, including in parts of West Bengal, where we were. And BangladeshTech.com decided they would do an enterprise at this village. So this village remains in a raised area where other people have taken up all the land around it. So it's like an island in other people's rice paddies. And it's got a big industrial thing across the road and sort of nothing for these people. And it's quite small. Like, the whole village would probably... maybe be twice the size of this picture theatre. And it's turned this into an industry that supports the whole village. And not only do they do the thing with helping people make and produce the actual Dokra items, which are usually little statues and beads and things like that, but they also run things like on computer courses so that people can actually turn it into a proper business. They've set up a little museum so that there's a co-op that they encourage people to sell through, so there's not that jealousy. And you can walk through the whole village seeing people making this without any hard sell, which is a completely great sales technique, because in India there's not that many places where you can do that, and you can walk around and learn about what's happening, and I think people feel, you know, much more inclined to buy. It's so successful that even while we were there, some guys in business suits came in, like getting orders for stuff they were buying selling remotely. So... I think that they've been really small scale, but really successful. In Myanmar, Usumo, who is this gentleman here who said, just like the wrestler, Sumo, But he is a young entrepreneur, and he is working with women who are doing textiles, buying the textiles and selling them as they are. That's a chin blanket. But he's also turning them into other products to expand the market and create more market for these women. And so I thought I put the right picture up. There's a fantastic bag made out of one of these blankets, which, of course, I had to buy. But, you know, he does these shoes that are behind there, and that they're all out of traditional Myanmar textiles. And so one of the things is that people are doing quite often is, and you question, so is this safeguarding the intangible cultural heritage? And they say yes, because it keeps people doing it. They won't do it otherwise unless there's a market for it. And it's not enough people, you know, are going to buy a chin blanket. These things can take, you know, 3 months to make sometimes. They can take quite a long time because all the dyes and that are natural as well. I visited this bronze casting workshop in Mandalay, and it's the U Win Mung bronze casting workshop. And the owner showed me around. And he's been there for years. It's always been in this area. In Mandalay, when King Mindon set up the city, he set it up in his grid system. And there's these like little voids between the grid. I'm not sure I'd ever find my way around it. So there's, you know, people will describe a thing as a coordinate. Oh, it's between 37th and 36th and 47th and 48th Street. And you go, what? But anyway, so they have these grids, and the industries are still in the places where they were assigned. So each area had like industries that were assigned to it to create a workforce, create an employment force. So in this one, they make those large bronze Buddhas. They also make other things. They make, you know, a few trophy statues of generals and stuff and other bits and pieces as well. But their big trade is in these large Buddhas. They say the business is really booming. They've just sold three large Buddhas, which are, you know, we're talking something huge, to South Africa of all places. Who knew? But so they're actually the only place in Myanmar where these are made. So they're all done, again, with a lost wax method or a variation of it. And the first step is to build these mud figures, which are quite complex. It takes a long time, so they've got to dry in between before the gentleman whose head you can just see is actually putting the intricate details on them. Often the fingers are formed separately and then joined on later. And the clay is a special clay that comes from a river, which is quite a way away. And I said, you know, don't you use local soil? No, it's all from this one place. So there's always this interconnection in these things where they there's different, you touch on an intangible cultural heritage in one area, and it's linked to all these other areas that supply it. So so they basically build these things, then they cover them in this sort of a wax. It's like at your old grandma's floor tiles, you know, the old lino floor tiles, which they make out of wax, and they mix something with it. I don't know what it is, like a kerosene type stuff, some sort of oil. And then they form it into these squares, and then they warm in the sun, and once this is built, they put it all over it and smooth it all over it, and then they make another mould over the top, and then they pour hot bronze in, and they cook this baby overnight. So at 5 p.m. in the evening, the fire is lit, ready to go, and when they come back at 5 a.m. in the morning, they open it up. So the kilns are built, purpose-built for each item. You know, so they build these brick clay, these kilns around it. And then, of course, they have to do all the repairing of the bronze and then the smoothing off and the whatever. And quite often then they'll cover it. Sometimes they'll cover them with what do they call it? It's some black thing, which again is another plant that comes from somewhere else. Did I put it in here? I can't remember what it was. And but then they'll often put gold leaf over the top of it. So the gentleman who was showing me around, Zozo U, who's the manager, he says that his biggest problem is finding apprentices. That he had quite a few people working for him, but they're all, you know, older men. And he said, apprentices, when he started, you started like 10 or 12 years old, and you used to work for 6 years before you were considered trained. And he says, now, no, of course, no kid wants to do this. And they, one of the mechanisms that Myanmar is using, I'm not sure very successfully, they have a University of Arts and Culture, and that university has a feeder school, which is a school that has children who are interested in various art forms and crafts, and they will feed into that university. But he looked very doubtful that he thought that was working. So I think he's still struggling to find apprentices to assist him. So that idea of transmission and the fact that kids now are walking around with mobile phones, which a few years ago weren't available in Myanmar, five years ago you couldn't easily get a phone. You had to go into a lottery. There's a lot of threats that actually face things as well, and some of those are from, as I said, people mechanising things from outside, putting something as a cheap imitation. And I was lucky enough to... So some of the threats are about new technologies and others can be a byproduct of the ill-informed efforts to safeguard or conserve ICH, such as decontextualising it. But the Intergovernment Committee has just recently, the Intergovernmental Committee for ICH has just recently put out a ethical principles for safeguarding intangible cultural heritage. And that's supposed to assist with some of this in terms of setting out the principles that everyone involved in this will abide by, and though, you know, recognising that culture is dynamic and living. However, all of the countries who ratified this, often the decisions are governmental decisions that are things that are decontextualising things. So when I went to have a look at this gold leaf workshop, it's called the Ung Dagon Gold Leaf Workshop, and it's in Mandalay. It's in a funny little street where all the gold leaf workers are, and all day all you hear them is banging their hammers. And you wouldn't want to have a nap in any of those places there in the middle of the day. So I did have a little video, but it's not working. I couldn't get it to work. I won't even bother trying because it worked on my computer and then didn't work on the one at work. But you can find it. If you look up Gold Leaf Myanmar, there's a little Getty video which actually talks about gold leaf. I think part of it was at this actual workshop. So gold leaf, which I've always just thought is such a simple thing, is not so simple at all and takes a long time to make. The paper that is used in the gold leaf making takes 3 years to make. And it's a special paper made of rice stalks, and is made somewhere else, again, another place along the Arawadi. So, in fact, again, there's that connection, but they only use things from that place, and it's only there. And that paper, there's three different types of paper used in the process. So in this figure where the guys with the hammers, you can see for the archaeologists, the cultural heritage, tangible cultural heritage, you can see these sloping stones they have that they actually use to as the base. They put the piece of gold is actually in between, wadded layers of gold in between this coarse paper and then wrapped around with leather, and then they just bang it for like 1,200 strokes of these heavy hammers. And as I said to the guy there, I said, so they're all young? And he said, oh yeah, it's a young man's thing, they're too old. You have to become the supervisor or the owner by the time you're older. So these guys just hammer 1,200 times a day. And that little thing in front, I asked them, how do you know when it's ready? And they use a water clock. So it's that bowl and the little spool in front. And they said, but you can tell from the sound the gold talks to you, because you get to a point, usually after about 1,000 hits, where you can open it up and have a look and see how it is. And then it's, for some reason, the women get the job of divvying up all the gold and then a workshop. And they basically it's hammered multiple times before it gets this ultra-thin bit, because they quarter it and then send it back down for hammering again. So it's absolutely thin. It's like a smear when they put it on your hand. It's like a smear of gold. And then they package it all up in these little packages. But just recently, a Shwe Dagon temple, pagoda, which is in Yangon, not Mandalay, so the other end of the Yarrawaddy, is one of their biggest customers. So the gold leaf is made in Mandalay, comes down the Arawadi to Shwe Dagon. And just recently, Shwe Dagon, the trustees, put out their tender for refurbishment and for the service supply of services in terms of gold leaf. And they chose a company that was, I think, in Vietnam or something, I think they said, which is mechanised and can make their gold leaf much cheaper because they just smash it, you know, with a thing. And then the packaging is made to look almost exactly the same as the Odegong Gold Leaf Workshop. And, you know, for me, I mean, presumably there was a word different in there somewhere, but for me, not reading Burmese, it looked exactly the same. So it was a complete rip-off of their thing. So 200 gold leaf workers took to the street in protest, and they petitioned the government to make the trustees change this, because they said all of them would be losing their jobs. They'd, you know, 20% loss in gold leaf sales because it was going to this outside source. So The ministry, that's created a lot of interest in Gold Leaf. And the Ministry for Culture and Religious Affairs has held discussions between the trustees, the pagoda now, and the society, which resulted in the tender documents being altered. So U Zor Ming Ung claims that Myanmar gold leaf is superior to that of Thailand and Vietnam because it's purer gold, it's 24 carat gold, and the others use 14 carats. And it's finer and it adheres better. The way they make it, it's so fine that it actually almost sticks by itself. So now the interest in this has sparked the ministry to document the process, and they believe that, in fact, it might be one of the items that they're going to nominate for addition to the list of representative heritage, intangible cultural heritage of humanity. Salt making is another interesting one. I mean, not necessarily, you know, wow, it's probably done in a similar way in many places, but salt making in Myanmar is still done very traditionally. It's all done by local families. So we toddled over this strange little bridge here, and there's a paddock of obviously salty saline soils, and people plough it. So it's got little runnels down it, and then they wait for rain, and then the salt just rises to the surface. And then they scoop the salt into these little piles that you see up there, just thinly off the top, because they want the salt. They don't really want the dirt. And then they make a bowl out of that mound by putting water in it. So that large thing that looks like cement is just the dirt. And then gradually they swish it round, and then they put some straw in it to sort of filter it a bit. And at the bottom of that, they stick a piece of bamboo in the bottom. You probably can't see it in that. Bad choice of photos. At the bottom, they have a terracotta pot, and they have a piece of bamboo they stick in the bottom, and gradually the water sinks down through the dirt, taking the salt, obviously in solution, into it. And then they go into this little tiny lean-to thing where some girl with perfect complexion, because she's sitting there in the steam all day, using peanut shells to get a constant hot heat, evaporates away the water, and you get that big pile of white salt at the end. So it's a really hands-on family business, salt making in Myanmar. So, you know, they could easily do, you know, all those trendy Byron Bay salts. I'm sure this is probably much better. Textiles. Everywhere you go, when you're talking about ICH in Asia, people complain about people stealing their textile technology. They're a popular and diverse form of ICH. Indonesian batik, we've all bought a batik sometime in our life, I'm sure. It's a long history of acculturation. They've got diverse patterns, makes it very popular for sale. But because it's very popular, other people go, we can make it cheaper and we can copy it. You know, and, you know, instead of using the resistance method by, you know, pouring little bits of wax on the cloth and dipping it in your dye and then taking it out and waiting for that to dry, then melting the wax off and then putting new wax on to get another colour. Instead of doing all that, we can just print it in a factory. And, you know, one of the things, if you buy a batik and it's not printed on both sides, if it's a machine one, it'll probably be plain, like, you know, when you buy fabric and it's not reversible on the back. But if it's a batik, the colour will go right through it. In 2009, the Indonesian government had the batiks from Java particularly added to the representative list of the ICH of humanity. And it was part of their ideas were around protecting it and raising awareness that it is a specific thing. The other thing there is the chin blanket, as you saw it. Now, the story behind chin blankets, that for a newlywed chin woman, they weave a large blanket, and then she and her husband will be wrapped upon their deaths on the blanket. So it's an anti-glory box. When one partner dies, the blanket is cut in two, and one half used to wrap them, and the other half is kept until the other person dies. And they think that the blanket will reunite them, the two spirits, one day. So the blankets come from a very special place in family life. But people have obviously worked out that they're very attractive and people want to buy them and want to sell them, and so it is quite a large trade, but they can take, you know, 3 months to make. So in Kachin State in Myanmar, Myanmar's a very diverse country, it's got lots of different ethnicities in it. And in Kachin State, which is the most northern province in Myanmar, there are 8 different looms, I'm being told, for each for a different weaving purpose. One's for a hat, one's for a sarong, you know, a longi, one's for blanket. So there's different looms for different things. So you can see that the technology around these things is really complex sometimes. And, you know, just changing that and being able to buy something cheaply at the shop, you can lose all of it at once. So, and one woman there said she believes cultural heritage is the most valuable things for communities. And I think you can see that in terms of the way that, culture has remained very tightly controlled in Myanmar. It's the Department of Culture and Religious Affairs and has an ex-general in charge of it, so must be important. So around textiles, nearly everyone complains about things being stolen. And the batik thing, I think people, you might have read something about the batik fights that went on a few years back. But the government, Indonesian government, part of the reason they listed it was to protect it. Not that listing it protects it, but raising the people's knowledge about it and the idea that this is actually something very is ours and very linked to culture is the part of protecting it. They also then introduced a thing called a batik mark, a bit like wool, you know, the wool thing that came out many years ago. So now the batik that's from an artisan actually has a symbol from the batik industry. So it basically is stamped as being an authentic batik, if the producer is actually someone who is part of that system. So I think that idea of using the UNESCO Convention as a way of protecting cultural heritage is something that works sometimes and other times has some issues with it, but it's something that people are looking to because if I can say it's mine, sometimes they're looking at it competitively. I went to three different countries and they all said they were looking at putting, what's the other country looking at putting up? And I went, oh, I don't know, they're talking about lacquerware. Lacquerware? We've got lacquerware. And I said, you know, it's not supposed to be a competition. You know, you could all join together. Oh, but, you know, there's some impractical aspects of the convention in that expectation that some countries will get on with each other when they never will. But anyway, so can you collect up people's little post-it notes for me, Joel? Because we're getting to that point. So how could this apply to Australia? We're so three people looked at this and no one picked that up. We're ethically diverse. We're ethnically diverse. What I hear all the time when people say, but it wouldn't work in Australia because, you know, sort of might work for Indigenous stuff, but, you know, what's our culture? And but our culture is someone else's culture because, you know, it's either a Celtic culture or it's, you know, Yugoslavian culture or it's somebody else's culture. But I think we need to look at this a little bit closer because, in fact, that's not a problem, really, with this convention. With Aboriginal heritage, as I said, it's a bit easier to see it. You know, there's some benefits that could flow, the enhanced status for arts and crafts, increased incentive to protect traditional copyright intellectual property, a boost in regional and remote economies. I mean, one of the things that impresses me, in fact, I tried to get a project up with some funding from the India Council to bring ballantech.com over and do a workshop with these young Indigenous people in Cape York who set up an association very interested in protecting and promoting their cultural heritage. And so I thought it would be interesting to see if you could adapt a model that would work in a remote community here that would provide people with, you know, not a major business, but a business that supports families, that actually works in a local economy. And so I think there's potentially real benefits in this. It'll strengthen the role and status of senior community members and encourage transmission of culture. Some people in some places, let's face it, you know, it's not all about respecting elders. In a lot of communities I've been to, old people sit there ignored until they die, and then people say, oh, Suti, did you record their story? Did you record their culture? You know, after the fact. Because like all of us, you know, we're busy doing other things or we've got interest in other things. But if you make it relevant, if you give those people, if you make their tradition relevant again, then of course people will want to learn it, want to know it. Although the bronze workshop might argue with me there. But you know, I think that will flow. If there's jobs, if there's a chance to see that this actually contributes in today's world, then I think more young people will pay more attention. It'll provide opportunities for families or clans based on micro-enterprises, based on country. And there'll be symbiotic benefits for the environment as traditional practices are maintained. I mean, it's all very well to say that traditional practices are great. But we see over and over again, unless there's some incentive, you know, maybe through, you know, the ranger programs or whatever, that unless there's an incentive where someone is paying for it, there's a fee for service, it good intentions fail and other things take over. But what about the Australian and colonial and post-colonial heritage? That's where people find it really hard to understand how this might work. But if you think about the convention, it has an emphasis actually on multinational listings. Falconry was listed from everywhere from the Philippines to Saudi Arabia. Like there was, I don't know how many countries, about 15 countries that were part of that listing. So there's this idea that you can actually do these cross-border things and look at where your traditions or roots might come from and look at cooperative things, building relationships, building diplomacy, all those sort of things. And again, there'd be an enhanced status for arts and crafts. So in the arts, between the cultural heritage places and sites, objects and places, and between the arts and crafts, the craft area falls down. I think in Australia is not something that's supported in the same way. And this would increase intergenerational connections, again, in the same way I was talking about for Indigenous communities. Again, boosting regional and remote economies, strengthen the role and status of senior community members and encourage transmission of culture, and new roles for local community networks, such as the Country Women's Association, for instance, perhaps. Integrity and promotion of Australian sports, such as AFL, and Jasmine at work would say calisthenics, because she keeps telling me it's totally Australian. Does anyone know that? Oh, there we go, another calisthenics person. I should have put it in. Also, the multicultural aspects of the background mean that you could be looking at things in terms of the diaspora of it. You could be looking at how things connect to other places, like dragon boat ceremonies and lion dancing or any of those sorts of things, connecting them together. In fact, you know, what would a true Chinese... and obviously there's difficulties in these and governments go, oh, no, not the multinational thing. There's a lot of diplomacy in that. But if you get them off the ground, they can be really amazing things. But, you know, if China actually did decide to do a fully multinational listing of some heritage, what would that look like? Because, you know, that's outdated now, but that's Chinese diaspora in 2011 in terms of places they are. So, in fact, some Chinese practices have spread across the world and are probably developed in different ways in the context of where they are. Similarly, you know, the Italian diaspora. There's been two major and now currently a third diaspora of Italian people. And so the first one was around 1880 and went right up to the unification of Italy. And then there was the one after the war, and that's the biggest one. There were Italians who came out to Australia before that, but, you know, the post-World War II movement of Italian people out from Italy was massive. And people say there's a third wave now because of economic issues and other things. So I think the figures I've got, they're really outdated. But according to the Public Register of Italian Residents Abroad, figures of Italians abroad rose from 3,106,251 in 2006 to 4,636,647 in 2015. It's growing by 49.something% in just 10 years. So it's a massive thing. And so I think Italians have made a massive contribution to our community and economy over time. And, you know, certainly have been cheering on because they managed to get, in 2017, their Art of Neapolitan Pizza, and I can play the little thing, that clip that comes with this.
I napoletani sono i creatori di un cibo popolare e nello stesso tempo di un bene culturale, di un bene comunitario, perché ha a che fare proprio con i fondamenti della società napoletana.
So the Art of Neapolitan Piazzolo, is anyone Italian here? Anyway, is a culinary practice comprising four different phases. Relating to preparation of the dough and the baking of the wood-fired oven. So they're the ones who really, you know, make the dough and then spin it round all the time. And so the element originates in Naples, and there's 3,000 Pizzaioli people living there and performing there regularly. It's interesting that they use the word performance. It's in the listing for that thing. But imagine if we actually started to think about really what our cultural heritage is. So what our neighbours have told us is that this is great stuff. There's positive engagement with local communities. There's good PR, both internally and abroad. There's increased tourism interest and potential. There's a boost to rural and remote economies. There's marketing and export opportunities. And there's a sense of national pride. Now, whether, obviously, there's ethical and political issues around national pride, so I'm not going to get into a nationalistic spiel. But this is good news for governments. And so it's really interesting that our government has, you know, steadfastly refused to ratify the convention. So now, I'm looking for some ideas here because I'm sure you would have come up from others. So what did you guys come up with? Sitting around the piano and singing with grandma and mum? Margaritas at my aunt's and listening to their crazy stories? Well, storytelling and story listening is obviously a very important part of everything. Scavenger hunts at Easter with clues on the eggs and cooking all day at Thanksgiving and everyone saying what they're thankful for. So, you know, obviously links with other countries here as well. Bedtime stories, sitting and just listening and playing music. Family values, respect of grandparents, so that intergenerational respect and transmission. That intergenerational thing of family all living together with multiple generations. Nan's Welsh cooking. I don't know. Wales is part of the United Kingdom, so they're not in it either. Methods of housekeeping. Who put that there? That's just... You haven't seen my house. So I'm not missing that. When we get that up and going, that would be a good one because doesn't that mean more maids? And then I can go on. Love of learning, interacting and understanding differences, cultures, all the things that are supposed to be actually part of the convention. Catering for family and friends. Put pizza nights. There we go. Phone calls on birthdays, yes, and cards. Christmas CDs played at Christmas. Photos of family members. So, you know, the Christmas tradition's an interesting one, isn't it? Because people, you often hear people, particularly from sort of the great white right, complaining that Christmas will go, you know, we've got too many other religions here now. We've had Easter holidays and, you know, probably half the population is no longer Christian. All of these sorts of things. But in fact, that is something that people will feel a real loss of. It's a tradition. And so we've got to be thinking of these things. How do we transition these? How do we maintain the traditions that make people feel, you know, reinforce their sense of identity without excluding others? So I think there's a lot of great ideas in here for me that I'll be able to put in my next talk. Putting up Christmas things. To John Farnham's Christmas album. Oh, my goodness. Annual summer week in Cozzy. There's a good one. Easter family picnics. A lot of Easter, obviously Easter was close on the, you know, brain. Singapore food from living there as a child. Yeah. Opening the smallest present under the tree on Christmas Eve. That was a cheat. There's someone here who's a cheat. Pizza making, another pizza. Oh, there we go. There's just some ideas that we can start thinking about. And as you think about this, you'll think more about what it is that makes up Australian culture. And I think it's what are the things you want to keep as you move forward? What are the things that are really important? What are the things that we can change and adapt from other people? And how we can build them into our heritage practice? How we can think about it in terms of the research we're doing for the students, because it's an area wide open for research. And that's it. Thank you very much. Questions? Marilyn.
Thanks very much, Sue, for all of that and the wonderful case studies and examples that you've given us. And I've just sort of set me thinking a little bit, but thanks so very much. A couple of things, and I guess I'm getting to the convention per se. As you know, there was quite a pushback at the time, before and around the time, wanting to expand on perhaps a convention already there, such as World Heritage. Mm. And I think in Australia, but other countries, but particularly here, we'd been pushing for, as you mentioned, the Borough Charter and things like that, that widening of recognition of heritage beyond the physical, built, wonderful, whatever. I won't go into all of those details. And I would actually argue that if you ask the average suburban person in Australia, they wouldn't carve up their sense of tradition or identity or sense of place into different bits because of different legislation. Mm. And that's a little bit what UNESCO has been doing. So, yes, One of the reasons for it was that acknowledgement of cultural diversity in an increasingly globalised world. We probably all wear the same sorts of clothes at the airport. We might have had different things for breakfast or whatever, but we, you know, that superficiality, but genuine also sort of taking over of look alike or being alike. But the convention itself then also starts to slice and dice. You've given the three different listings, and the safeguarding one is fantastic and the one at risk. But when you're listing something, you're identifying one element to put up, not the full culture. So what are we going to do? Are we going to have Lamington drives, or are we going to have two up on Anzac Day?
Well, I was told that Lamingtons aren't Australian. I was going to use that, but and then I'll put pavlovas, and they weren't going to be Australian. Well, so Anzac Day, thank God for Anzac biscuits, which are controlled by law,
well,
apparently.
And another comment, of course, because signing up, and of course countries are doing it that have got great diversity. In many countries, of course, many of the member countries, the diversity is localised. So a group, maybe a different ethnicity, lives in a particular area. Apart from our 300 to 500 Indigenous groups, we're mixed up. And the requirement of...
I'm going to challenge that, Marilyn.
You are,
because if you go to Vietnam, the city, into Hanoi, they run this... Because it's a bottoms-up... One of the things Marilyn's talking about is that... is also that these things are supposed to be a bottoms-up convention, whereas the World Heritage was seen as a more top-down convention, which is... And the bottoms-up thing is a bit of a misnomer because of course, the state party, the national government, is the signatory, and they're the only ones who've got the power to put something forward. But that aside, in Vietnam, they run it right down to commune level, and there's another division below that, which is basically almost like your neighbourhood street level. Yeah. And they run the things from there. So what's important there? Those things don't necessarily get to the list. But it's a bit like if you think back to the Register of the National State days.
I appreciate all of that. Mm. What I'm trying to say, and obviously other people are going to have comments to make, and there are some countries where there really are the community control, as hypothesised by the convention, does actually really work. I guess the point is that the convention requires a state party, a member country that has ratified it, to identify, to have inventories. And that's a huge task. If you're going to treat all the different groups, whether they're the mix that we have in urban areas or the mix in the slightly more diversified into regions such as Indigenous people within Australia, it's a huge task.
It is. But it's something, for instance, local governments, a form of government that I think should be abolished. But if we're going to keep local governments, they're always talking about how do we maintain the identity of our local area. This is a perfect way of doing it at the local government level because... You know, I think there are opportunities, different ways of looking at this. So instead of looking at the problem, we look at how we would like to do it.
But we don't have to join the convention to do that. Thank you.
Just briefly. there is, within ICOMOS, a number of... Australia ICOMOS, there are a number of national scientific committees. There's also...
Yes.
Intangible.
I should have mentioned that,
international,
sorry.
International committees on various topics, including intangible cultural heritage. But the National Committee has recently developed a practice note for heritage professionals for dealing with intangible cultural heritage in Australia. Now, ICOMOS, of course, as you've heard, is concerned with place. So it's intangible cultural heritage at place, not intangible cultural heritage that
across the
floats
domains.
Free, like language or something else. Not that that's unimportant, it's just that that's what ICOMOS deals with. So if people want to go to the ICOMOS website, they can find amongst the resources there this practice note, which includes a number of examples of the sort that Sue was talking about.
So. And in fact, they could join and get involved.
Oh, if they want to join, yes. I happen to be the one of the conveners, so if anyone wants to join, they can talk to me about it and we can make things happen.
I suppose one of my problems with... I understand and support the concepts. One of my problems with it is that some of the examples that you've shown, for example, go from an intangible cultural practice to a commercialised industrial activity at a different scale, with different products, And to me, the question is, what is actually being conserved here? What's being protected? If it came to Australia and Australia signed, I predict the first two things off the rank would be Anzac Day and all who sail in her, and the man from Snowy River and all who trample across the Cozzy.
That's why I put the drover in.
And so I think it's open to very great political manipulation of what is our cultural heritage in Australia, for example, where we don't have that deep culturally based set of behaviours that we all share.
That's right. And you could actually look at it that the there's nothing in the convention that says you have to immediately rush out and do everyone's intangible cultural heritage. I mean, and different places I've visited have looked at it in different ways. You've got to produce a list. You've got to do that sort of show your safeguarding. But some places have done it where they've actually focused on a small area where people are keen. There was a very interesting case in Vietnam with a form of singing. They got two forms of singing on the they had two forms of singing on the list of items in need of urgent safeguarding. One was the thing called Soan singing. The other one is something, kakao or something. And one of them they actually came up with a plan for, and they said, we're getting it off that list. We've got a plan. And they actually, it does link place to it. So they found one of the issues that it was threatened was there was a dwindling number of leaders, guild leaders who could sing, who could teach the singing. There was a lack of opportunities to perform it anymore, and there was a lack of this, and that was partly because there was a lack of the places. So the spaces in the community where that thing would be performed were going, shopping malls, other things like that. And so the government put, I don't know how many billion dong, quite a lot of money, and quite a lot of it went into conserving places and buildings, because they were essential to, they saw the promotion of this, the safeguarding of this element. And they picked it, and they had it almost off in danger. They went from having like dwindling number of people who could do it up to hundreds within a couple of years. And when asked why they chose that form of singing, they said the other singing wasn't appropriate for children, and because it was too much about love and, you know, sex, I think. And this form was a form that was that could be taught to children. So one of their ways of doing it was to have the senior people train up other senior qualified teachers, and then to run it through schools, not schools, after school. Didn't want to liaise with the Department of Education. That was too difficult. So after school activity, and then basically ended up with these performances because they'd reinstated the places. Now, there's lots of issues with that, but it's a thing that obviously people in that area want to do. And when I asked why that one and not the other one, was partly the nature of the singing and partly the fact that it was one province. So sometimes it's easier to work with committed people, as we all know, in one place, and to look at it holistically. So if you wanted to link the World Heritage Convention with this convention, there's nothing to stop us looking at a national park that's on the World Heritage List, like Kakadu or Uluru or any of them, and actually saying, well, let's look at all the intangible cultural heritage within here as well, and let's help Aboriginal people set up micro enterprises that maintain and promote those, link it to the Ranger program, all of those things. Why don't we do things more holistically?
Thank you. Hello, my name's Jenny. Thank you for bringing a lot of ideas together. One idea that I've been looking for and I haven't seen, and you might like to comment on, is what is lost and gained in gender identity. At the moment, I'm working, for example, with 300 or 400 families from South Sudan, where gender identity is very strong in their national culture, and the teenagers have nothing to replace it with when they try and become Australian Dinka, and there is no male image, for example, that lives up to South Sudanese male and vice versa. I'm not advocating that there should be gender differences, but I'm saying in a cultural context, gender is very clearly defined. If we have a new culture developing in Australia, what do we do about gender identity?
And I don't really have an answer to that, because no. I was mainly looking at the convention, but I think it is interesting, because these things, anthropologists have been dealing with these things for a long time. It's not that it's unknown that, in fact, people have senses of identity that can be very fragile if you take them out of their environment. So I think you're right. It is something that really needs to be looked at. And what is there that can... the obvious thing that often happens with young male refugees in Australia is, you know, soccer or footy or something that it gets them into a male bonding sort of environment. I do know some kids from Syria, which, that the community actually actively use that for. But that's not going to work for everyone because not everyone is going to be interested in that aspect of it. So I don't really have the answer to that at all. Sorry.
Well, can I finish? The choice, I mean, it's about everybody's choice, but I just wondered under the cultural guidelines whether protecting choice is also a priority or a principle. You know, it's not under defining gender by your sex particularly, but it's allowing you choice to have a stronger image or not such a strong image.
Yeah, in the 2003 convention, it's not really dealing with that at that level. It's dealing with it does deal with gendered practices, and all practices are eligible except for practices that are not considered to be humane or acceptable under the international human rights, like female genitalia mutilation is not something, even though it is something that some cultures would say, well, that is part of our cultural identity, whatever, that's not something that can be listed. But that convention is not going to solve all of your issues around gender, but certainly there are some, if you look through the things that are listed, there are different practices which are very gendered practices, and some of those will be singing, some of those will be performing, some of them might be gay performances. So there are, you know, and there's, you know, falconry, which tends to largely be a male dominated thing in most areas, although not solely. So there are very gendered things listed in there, but I'm not sure it's going to really be the answer. This is not going to be the vehicle that answers your particular needs in that area, I think.
Sorry, I just wanted to interject because I feel really quite uncomfortable with the notion that engendered culture is something that belongs to another or other, minority migrants, refugees and behaviour that needs to be considered. I mean, here in Australia, we're tackling head on the whole idea of toxic male culture, and it's not just something that needs to be addressed.
And not all gendered stuff is toxic either, I'd say. So, you know, I'm not
sure. But I think that when we're talking about particularly male culture, I think that there's a lot. Yeah.
Certainly going beyond the 2003 convention, but
so maybe it can be continued later on. But maybe we will just finish on that point and thank our speaker for a very interesting and engaging lecture. And we will give her the bottle of wine I'm sure she has been waiting for. So thank you very much, Sue.
Thank you.
And, yeah, I also want to just flag a few things that are coming up. So, in fact, we might ask Richard to tell what is happening immediately.
Okay. There is a symposium coming up in Canberra and Region Heritage, in the Canberra and Region Heritage Festival. It's a symposium in this space on the morning of the 4th of May. It's being advertised through various places, but it is on the National Museum website, and that's where you have to book. It's free, and there are some programs here. So, the title is Contemporary Archaeology and How Archaeology is Practiced Today. We've got five speakers. Mike is one of them. And Mike will be talking about Australian archaeology in Antarctica. We've got Emeritus Professor Richard Wright talking about the forensic archaeology of war crimes. We've got Dr. Alice Gorman, who's a space archaeologist, talking about Shadows of the Moon, the forgotten Apollo 11 heritage. Dave Johnston will be presenting a video on the Gollian Farm Aboriginal Ochre Quarry at Sutton, which is a video about shared heritage of place. And Dr. Ian Johnston will be talking about the repatriation of Indigenous material culture. And then there'll be a Q&A panel following. So, as I said, 4th of May in the morning from 10:30.
Okay. Thank you for that, Richard. Programs here. It's also, if you just Google Canberra Archaeology Society, it will come up in the events. I'll also just flag the lecture that happens after that, or at least to say that this is going to be the ACT Heritage Festival Symposium. Is the last time we're going to be in Visions Theatre. We're going to be moving to ANU while this theatre gets redeveloped. I think that's right, isn't it? But we very much hope to see you again when we reopen the Cass and Friends seminars at ANU later on in the year. And the next lecture, there's a bit of a break, so next lecture is 18th of September, and that is Andy Viduka, who's in the Department of Environment and Energy, talking about, I think, maritime archaeology. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much for coming.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.